Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. This week, episode 198, Raid on Old Tappan. I haven't really focused on the main Continental Army since we left the Battle of Monmouth, which took place in late June of 1778. Now, since then, we've gone through a bunch of episodes about attacks on upstate New York, which really didn't involve the main army. I also covered a few court-martials that were taking place during this time. This week, I want to catch up on what General Washington has been doing since the Battle of Monmouth. The British pulled out of New Jersey entirely. They had hunkered down on Manhattan Island, Staten Island, and Long Island. Washington's Continentals camped first in northern New Jersey near Paramus, hoping that the French fleet would assault New York from the sea. When Admiral D'Estaing opted to abandon that effort and move on to Rhode Island, Washington moved his army to White Plains, New York. From there, Washington could block any overland march from New York City to relieve the British at Newport, Rhode Island. While the Continentals dug in at White Plains, British General Henry Clinton sent 4,000 reinforcements to Rhode Island via ship. Clinton wanted to keep Washington from sending more reinforcements to Rhode Island, so he sent several regiments north to harass the Continentals at White Plains. Clinton already had a garrison at Fort Knyphausen, formerly known as Fort Washington, on the northern end of Manhattan. He deployed several regiments north of Manhattan Island to Kingsbridge, which was only a few miles south of the American lines at White Plains. These forward detachments were mostly Hessians and local loyalists, notably the Queen's Rangers under Lieutenant Colonel John Graves Simcoe. Another loyalist regiment under Lieutenant Colonel Bannister Tarleton, and a third under Lieutenant Colonel Andreas Emmerich. These three regiments, along with several companies of Hessian Jägers, hoped to harass and distract the main Continental Army. On the American side, closest to the front lines, were several companies of Virginia riflemen, as well as the Stockbridge Indians. I've mentioned the Stockbridge Indians on a few occasions. These warriors had lived in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where they lived in homes and had interacted closely with the colonists for many years. They had their own militia, and they joined the Patriot cause early on. These men had been present at Bunker Hill. They had fought as Continentals ever since. They were the same soldiers who stopped the British advance at Barron Hill near Philadelphia, allowing General Lafayette to escape with his main force. They had a reputation as fierce fighters and good soldiers, and they served under the command of their chief, Daniel Ninham. In July of 1778, the Loyalists on patrol had run into the Stockbridge Indians and had taken a number of casualties. Colonels Simcoe, Tarleton, and Emmerich resolved to attack and destroy this menace to their men. On the morning of August 31st, Colonel Emmerich marched out to confront the Stockbridge Indians. The two groups began a firefight. Although the Loyalists outnumbered the Stockbridge Indians, the Loyalists began falling back slowly as the firefight continued, while maintaining a line of fire. Now, this was all part of the plan. As Emmerich's Loyalists pulled back, the Stockbridge pursued them. This drew them into an area where they quickly became surrounded by hundreds of Queen's Rangers and nearly 200 saber-wielding cavalry under Bannister Tarleton. There was a brutal hand-to-hand combat, but the greatly outnumbered Stockbridge were nearly completely slaughtered. Chief Ninham, according to accounts, made a stand and ordered his warriors to flee. He was cut down by a saber, as were most of his men. Accounts differ, but the company of 50 to 60 warriors suffered between 17 and 37 killed. About 20 of them managed to escape and return to the main Continental camp. General Charles Scott dispatched 300 Continentals, but by the time they were deployed, the Loyalists had pulled back to their main lines. 2 weeks after the Kingsbridge Massacre, Colonel Mordecai Gist's 3rd Maryland Regiment held the front line position in front of the main army. Once again, Colonels Simcoe, Tarleton, and Emmerich developed a maneuver to trap and destroy the lead regiment. Guided by local loyalists, the British forces encircled the Marylanders for a dawn attack on the morning of September 16th. They launched their assault and quickly overwhelmed the Continentals. However, the British had failed to cut off all avenues of escape as planned. Gist and his soldiers escaped over an unguarded bridge and made their way back to the main Continental lines. Attacks were not the only concern of the Continentals. As I said, Clinton had dispatched 4,000 regulars to Newport, Rhode Island to assist in the defense of that garrison. After the French fleet gave up and sailed for Boston, the Continentals under General John Sullivan also gave up their attempted invasion and pulled back out of Aquidneck Island. The threat of a Continental victory had vanished. With that, the commander of the British reinforcements, General Charles Grey, figured he should do something before returning to New York. On September 6th, his troop transports sailed to Buzzards Bay, Massachusetts. With the support of Admiral Howe's Navy, still in the area after the French fleet had left, Grey landed near the town of New Haven. His soldiers burned homes, looted property, and seized a few suspected rebels. All night and the next morning, the regulars terrorized the locals and marched without much resistance. A Patriot fort across the river in Fairhaven fired on the ships, but the garrison took massive return fire from the fleet. The fort garrison spiked their guns and abandoned the fort. The next day, Grey marched his regulars up the creek to a point where they could cross, then marched down the east bank to Fairhaven, where they continued their destruction. The local militia managed to assemble about 150 men who fired on some of the raiding party. Not prepared for a full battle, the British eventually returned to their ships and sailed away. Next, Grey sailed his transport to Martha's Vineyard. Due to poor winds, it took the ships several days to reach the island. There, he demanded that the locals deliver 300 oxen and 10,000 sheep, as well as all their weapons and public funds. The locals dragged their feet, taking about 2 days to assemble half of what the British demanded. Grey landed several regiments, which rounded up the animals, all the militia weapons, and about 950 pounds sterling, which had been collected in taxes for the Continental Congress. With that, the British fleet returned to New York. Grey reported only one man killed and four wounded and 16 missing from the mission. He also reported that his men had killed four rebels and taken 16 prisoners with the intent of exchanging them for missing British soldiers who were presumed captured. Washington heard about these raids, but was not terribly concerned. He was considering an all-out attack on Manhattan. He could take the northern half of the island, or perhaps take all of it, with so many British being deployed to Rhode Island. There's no record of Washington discussing the attack with his officers, but a draft plan for the attack was found among Washington's records. It would have been a pretty daring move, but without clearing the British Navy from the water around Manhattan, it faced serious challenges, which is probably why Washington did not pursue the plan. He did ask his general officers about what they thought about the probability of the success of an attack on New York. Most of the officers rejected the idea. Because the British still controlled the Hudson and East Rivers, they could bring up troops and artillery to use against the Americans at any time. That was the whole reason that they had abandoned Manhattan back in 1776 without much of a fight. Further, even if the Continentals took northern Manhattan, there was not much to prevent General Clinton from marching thousands of regulars from Rhode Island to strike at the Continental rear while the forces in New York attacked its front. The Continentals could easily be walking into a trap. Washington did not have very good intelligence about the British numbers and the positions in New York. There were just too many variables. So he opted not to pursue the plan any further. By contrast, the British had pretty good intelligence on American positions. Deserters, loyalists, and paid spies, including Ann Bates, a loyalist from Philadelphia, were providing General Clinton with such intelligence. General Clinton, as always, maintained an espionage network so that he could keep tabs on the size and positions of the Continentals. Ann Bates became one of Clinton's key assets in New York. She was a 30-year-old schoolteacher from Philadelphia and a loyalist. Her husband served in the British Army. During the British occupation of Philadelphia, one of General Clinton's civilian spy recruiters, a man named John Craig, began using Bates for local intelligence gathering. As a woman, Bates would not raise much attention or be seen as a threat. When the British evacuated Philadelphia, Bates' husband marched with the army to New York. Bates became a camp follower, leaving her home and most of her family behind. In New York, she reached out to Craig once again, hoping to find some work. Craig, along with Clinton's intelligence officer, Major Duncan Drummond, recruited Bates for a more difficult mission. They proposed to send her straight into the Continental camp to collect intelligence. Bates adopted the pseudonym Ann Barnes, a civilian peddler of goods. The British provided her with money to buy a sack of odds and ends to sell and sent her to march north to join Washington's army at White Plains. She spent more than a week in July roaming around the Continental camp, counting soldiers and cannon, listening in on conversations. After selling all of her goods, she simply walked back to New York through various checkpoints and reported what she had learned. Her handlers then sent her back to White Plains twice more in August, where she gathered more intelligence, including overhearing a discussion on the planned invasion of Long Island, as well as reporting on troop movements to Rhode Island. Officers seemed unconcerned that this woman was capable of gathering military intelligence. Her cover was solid, and she kept no written notes of what she had discovered. On her third trip to White Plains, a British deserter recognized her and reported her. Even so, Bates was able to elude capture and return to the British lines. The discovery, of course, ended Bates's undercover activity at Washington's camp, but she did continue to engage in other espionage missions for the British. On September 16th, Washington began moving his main army from New York, settling in Fredericksburg, a small village a few miles northwest of Danbury, Connecticut. From there, Washington set up defensive lines that dispersed his army from Danbury, Connecticut to Fishkill, New York. Washington could move his army south against New York if needed, but could also march it into New England if the British opted to expand their coastal raids on New England towns into something larger. Washington figured that if the British went on the offensive at all, it would be a thrust up the Hudson River again in an attempt to cut off New England, or it would attack the French fleet, which was under repair in Boston. From his position, Washington could pivot easily to either location. Washington, however, was not ready to consider any other major campaigns. He was still wrapping up those court-martials of several of his top generals that I discussed a few weeks ago. Several of his top officers were fighting duels with each other, and others were unhappy about losing commands because the army had to consolidate its regiments. Once Washington left White Plains in mid-September, he was putting some distance between his army and the enemy. As the Continentals pulled back, the frontline Loyalist regiments advanced, leading to a few more skirmishes. The British, however, were not prepared for any major offensive operations either. General Clinton was still under orders to ship most of his army to the West Indies or other parts of the empire. He was in no position to take and hold more territory than he already had. Even with the reduction in men, Clinton still had an army in the tens of thousands, not to mention loyalist civilians, all of whom needed to be fed. The British also needed to collect supplies for the regiments who were about to ship out to other parts of the empire. Much of the needed food came from Long Island. Some was still shipped in from more distant locations. With the immediate threat of an American attack seemingly gone when Washington's army pulled north, the British leadership turned their attention to another source, New Jersey. The British had maintained two small toeholds in New Jersey. One was at Sandy Hook, the other was at Paulus Hook. Both were right on the coast where Navy ships could protect the outposts. With the main Continental Army now well up into New York, New Jersey defenses relied primarily on local militia. A year earlier, even during the Forage Wars, the British had held much larger areas in northern New Jersey. They had been able to rely on that area for food and supplies. Many of the locals were loyalists who were happy to trade with the British, who valued their protection and hard currency. General Clinton did not want to leave large outposts in New Jersey where they would be vulnerable to attack. However, he was fine with short raids into the region to capture supplies. Washington had deployed a regiment of light dragoons to the area with the goal of obtaining intelligence about British troop levels and movements. Colonel George Baylor had only just resumed command of the regiment after several months away on a recruitment tour. Baylor was a Virginia officer who had served briefly as an aide-de-camp to General Washington. The British were aware of the presence of these Continentals. General Gray, having returned from New England, dispatched about 400 regulars on a night raid into New Jersey for the purpose of attacking and destroying the enemy. As he had at Paoli, Gray ordered his men not to load their muskets, but to rely on the bayonet. He also ordered no prisoners. Soldiers were to kill the enemy, even if trying to surrender. The British received precise intelligence about where a dozen officers and over 100 men were sleeping on the night of September 26th. The regulars moved in after midnight and put everyone to the bayonet. There does not appear to have been much resistance, as the sleeping Americans were caught by surprise. There are multiple accounts of soldiers having surrendered, only to have their captors receive orders to put the prisoners to the bayonet. A couple of men who were dispatched in this way were left for dead, but managed to survive multiple bayonet wounds and report what had happened. Casualty reports indicate that only 15 men were killed outright. Another 54 were wounded or taken prisoner. Colonel Baylor and several of his officers attempted to hide in the chimney of the home where his officers were sleeping. The attackers found them and bayoneted the men. Baylor managed to survive and was taken prisoner. The British also came across New Jersey militia, which they dispatched without quarter. The Tappan Massacre, as it came to be called, was part of a larger raid by the British. On the night of September 22nd, the British regiments crossed the river into Paulus Hook and began tracking the enemy. At the same time, General Clinton assembled a much larger force of about 10 or 11,000 soldiers in northern Manhattan. His intent was to begin a grand forage into Bergen County, New Jersey. Clinton thought he might provoke a Continental attack, which would give his army a chance to defeat the Continentals. If the enemy remained in their defenses, then the British would just have an opportunity to sweep through the region for any needed supplies. After taking out the enemy soldiers in the immediate area, the British began collecting hay, produce, and cattle to ship back to New York. Dozens of ships ferried supplies across the Hudson River as pickets kept guard against attack. Continental General William Maxwell commanded a few regiments in Elizabethtown to the south. Washington also deployed Major General Lord Stirling to contest the enemy's actions in Bergen County. Stirling used his forces to harass the enemy and succeeded in burning several ships, but the British collection efforts proceeded along anyway. Similarly, General Charles Scott commanded Continentals and militia in Westchester, New York, where they made several raids and ambushes, which inflicted casualties but did not deter the British from holding the field and continuing their forage. After about 3 weeks, the British had collected the supplies they wanted and returned to New York City. George Washington received intelligence that the British planned to evacuate New York. This, of course, proved false. The British would remain in control of the city. Clinton did, however, ship a large portion of his New York garrison, as per his orders from London, to other parts of the empire. Over the next few weeks, thousands of British regulars boarded transport ships, 5,000 would go to the West Indies, another 3,000 would go to Florida, and 700 to Halifax. The war in France meant that the British had to protect their colonies in the West Indies and perhaps might capture some vulnerable French islands. The British also hoped to reclaim several southern colonies, where they believed they would be able to rally more local loyalists to support their efforts. For the remainder of the war, the number of British soldiers in North America would never come close to the numbers that they had in 1776 and 1777. London was writing off New England and the mid-Atlantic states for the time being. The attempt to suppress the rebellion quickly had been a failure. Now, the ministry had to contend with a much larger war with France, meaning North America was no longer a priority. Clinton would never again deploy such a large force from New York City. Although everyone thought they would resume at some point, major combat operations north of Virginia had effectively come to an end. Next week, I want to take a look at another operation that was taking place during this same time, involving Pulaski's Legion and the massacre of Little Egg Harbor in southern New Jersey. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. My thanks to Trey Nance, George Davis, Lewis White, and Robert Hunter for support of this podcast at the Alexander Hamilton Club level on Patreon. Thanks also to Mike Hager for his support on Patreon in the Robert Morris Circle. I also appreciate the one-time gifts via PayPal or Venmo from Brenda Richman, Jim Chapman, and John Dillard. Thanks to everyone who helps to chip in to support the costs of running this podcast. I also wanted to note a recent change in the style of the podcast. After I added the after show some time ago, I put the after show after the episode close music, that excerpt from the fife and drum tune called Crown Point from the Sturbridge Colonial Militia. I did that to mark the end of the main show, and because at first I wasn't sure if I wanted to make the after show a regular feature. Later, I also started playing the closing music a second time at the end of the after show as well. Now, I think having the after show come after the close music led to some confusion for people who just ended the show after the music and therefore missed the after show. So, my recent change was to stop using the closing music at the end of the main episode. Instead, I've inserted a brief fife and drum snippet that I've also used in my special episode interviews. In this case, the fife and drum notes the separation from the main show from the after show, and going forward, I'll just play the closing music at the end of the after show. There may someday appear some commercials between the two fife and drum calls, but for now, I'm not inserting commercials into the episode. That may change, as I said, down the road. Really depends on whether I get enough donation support to cover my costs or whether I need to look for other revenue streams. So, anyway, I just wanted to note the format change in case anyone was confused. I'm always open to feedback. You can find my email address on my website at www.amrevpodcast.com. You can also reach out to me on Twitter at amrevpodcast or through my Facebook group. Links to all of these, of course, appear on each blog episode or in the podcast notes. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, I'm always happy to hear from you. So this week, I discuss some of the final efforts by the British in New York before they finally had to ship off the bulk of their army to other parts of the empire. General Clinton was frustrated that after finally getting the command that he wanted, he found that the North American command was becoming a sideshow in a much larger war. Even so, Clinton made every effort to serve as the good soldier and do what he could with the resources that he had. His efforts to recruit spies was standard practice by good military officers at the time. I mentioned the work of Ann Bates this week. Fans of the TV show AMC's Turn are familiar with the character who appears in season 4 as Mrs. Barnes. That was the name that Bates used while traveling undercover to the Continental Camp. Of course, the show Turn is mostly about the Culper spy ring, a topic I plan to cover in an upcoming episode. The real Ann Bates continued to serve as a spy. When her husband was transferred to South Carolina later in the war, Ann followed him. Near the end of the war, the Bateses moved back to England. There, her husband, well, abandoned her. Bates became destitute and applied for a pension based on her espionage work during the war. It's primarily through that petition and the letters confirming her work from British officers that we know about Bates's service to the British Empire during the American Revolution. General Clinton used his gathered intelligence to risk the foraging expedition into New Jersey. Clinton figured that if the Continentals attacked in force, he could have the battle he wanted, but was not permitted to start himself because of the orders he'd received from London. If the Continentals held back, then, well, he could forage for what he wanted for his army and prove that the British were not afraid to march out of their defenses and just take what they wanted. If you want to read more about the events surrounding the New York occupation in 1778 and the raids into Bergen County, my book recommendation this week is Grand Forage, 1778, The Battleground Around New York City, by Todd Braisted. This book covers in detail the same events that I summarized today. It's a relatively succinct book, less than 200 pages, not counting notes and index, but it gives a good coverage to this relatively ignored period in the war. The author, Braisted, is a former president of the Bergen County Historical Society, where the forage happened. He has written or co-written a number of other books involving events in the New Jersey area, usually from a Loyalist or British perspective. He's also written a number of articles for the Journal of the American Revolution and has appeared as a guest historian on several TV shows. His book, Grand Forage, was published in 2016 by Westholm Publishing, the same group that produces the Journal of the American Revolution. My online recommendation this week is an older book on archive.org called Mahika Nyack, A History of the Stockbridge Nation by John Davidson. This is a look into the Stockbridge Indians, who played such a decisive role in the early years of the Revolution, and who suffered from the battlefield massacre that I talked about today. The book itself is rather short, less than 100 pages, and it covers the Stockbridge Indians during the 18th and 19th centuries. It doesn't particularly focus on their Revolutionary War service. However, it is an interesting example of the treatment of Indian tribes. The Stockbridge did everything right, and by the word right, I mean that the natives did everything they really could to ingratiate themselves with the Europeans who settled all around them. They had adopted European customs, religion, and lifestyles. They provided military support to the Patriot cause. Yet, despite all this, the Massachusetts tribe eventually lost its land and was pushed aside in the name of progress, ending up out in Wisconsin. A reading about Native American history in the U.S. can sometimes be a bit depressing. There are good arguments that the treatment was perhaps sometimes necessary to advance society, but you can't help but feel for the victims of this progress. It's an interesting story, and it's one that we all should know. So, if this interests you, check out Mahika Nyack, A History of the Stockbridge Nation, by searching for it on archive.org, or use the direct link on my website at www.amrevpodcast.com. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.